he still says that Kim is going to live up to his promises. So there's a lot to dissect in those 280 characters.
Conflicting views on North Korea. It's Monday, May 27th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Glad to have you with us. Find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Rohingya water shortage. Rolling Thunder parks its bikes after one last ride. Whale-watching drones, deep-sea trash, and eat your broccoli. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. President Donald Trump and his national security advisor are publicly at odds about the seriousness of the threat currently posed by North Korea. In a Sunday morning tweet from Tokyo, Trump issued a retort to John Bolton, who the previous day had told reporters that there was no doubt North Korea's recent test firing of short-range ballistic missiles violated a United Nations resolution. Bolton's remark was the first by a U.S. official describing the North Korean launches as a violation of U.N. resolutions. Trump's tweet on North Korea caused confusion and consternation, not only within the administration, but also among America's allies in the region, according to senior White House officials traveling with the president. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke via Skype with Vipin Narang, associate professor of political science at MIT and a member of MIT's Security Studies program. He asked Narang who was correct, President Trump or his national security advisor.
John Bolton is not incorrect. It is a violation of UN Security Council resolutions. But Trump's tweet yesterday, there's a lot going on in that tweet. In addition to, responding to John Bolton, he also, takes the opportunity to agree with Kim Jong-un in his characterization of Joe Biden as low IQ. He still says that Kim is going to live up to his promises. So there's a lot to dissect in those 280 characters, none of which I think are particularly helpful to the process.
What is the most important as far as you're concerned?
For a long time, Kim Jong-un has been pretending to disarm and Trump has been basically pretending to believe him. And now we're at the point where, how long can this continue? Now, it's certainly the case. So, yes, it's true that the short-range ballistic missile test violated UN Security Council resolutions. But it's also true that according to President Trump's understanding of the missile test moratorium, it didn't. The problem is, Kim Jong-un is also, I think, trying or potentially approaching, breaking point. He has domestic politics also to deal with. And the short-range ballistic missile test may just be kind of the beginning of a maximum pressure campaign of Kim Jong-un's own to try to get the United States to moderate its negotiating position. Now, the question is whether President Trump is willing to negotiate to moderate America's negotiating position, which at Hanoi was very maximalist. It basically demanded that Kim Jong-un unilaterally surrender all of his weapons of mass destruction programs and his ballistic missile programs up front before any sanctions relief. Now, that's not what Kim Jong-un was expecting. And so if President Trump says, OK, this isn't a short-range ballistic missile this ballistic missile test doesn't violate any of the agreements we've had in the past, but I'm still not willing to moderate the U.S. negotiating position, then Kim Jong-un may just start testing more frequently and test longer-range missiles to see how long, President Trump is willing to keep his head in the sand and unwilling to moderate his position. I think we're entering a very precarious phase, and North Korea has very clearly indicated to the United States that there's an end-of-year deadline for the United States to come back to kind of a step-by-step phasing, phase process in the negotiating, in negotiations. And we'll see. The clock is ticking, and we'll see whether, Kim Jong-un does extend or push the line on these tests, and whether Trump still continues to deny that they're provocations and or violations of at least the spirit of the Singapore process.
So what happens in your mind when that point is reached where the U.S. won't take anymore?
Well, so the risk is that Kim Jong-un tests one missile too many or one too far in the next coming months and Trump just flips. And we've seen that if Trump feels betrayed, he can lash out very aggressively. And there is John Bolton standing there with the only other alternative to the Hanoi and Singapore process, which is, the American and North Korean approach at this point is kind of, call it denuclearization by diplomacy. We know that Kim Jong-un isn't going to give up his nuclear weapons program willingly and voluntarily, but there are caps and freezes that we can possibly negotiate. But if that doesn't work and Trump says, okay, Kim has just betrayed the trust and the spirit of this process, John Bolton has advocated the only other alternative, which is denuclearization by force. And that means, you know, what Lindsey Graham has said, which is basically trying to, you know, destroy North Korea's nuclear weapons facilities and program through military action. And the problem is North Korea has nuclear weapons. And, you know, the chance that a nuclear weapon goes off in the region or against the United States when you attempt a military action to get rid of them is non-trivial. And so, you know, that's the alternative. And the risk is very, very high that, you know, you end up in a military conflict that could result in a nuclear use.
Well, in the tweet, President Trump also said that he has confidence that Kim Jong-un will keep his promise to me in moving toward denuclearization. That's just a continuation and a reinforcement, one would think, of Trump's personal diplomacy, which he thinks still works.
Right. And there, you know, there are two ways to interpret that. One is, you know, there's the missile testing moratorium promise. The second is, you know, the President Trump still insists and Secretary Pompeo still insists that Kim Jong-un promised to disarm the fully verified denuclearization of North Korea. Secretary Pompeo said that Kim said this to his face half a dozen times. Here's the problem. North Korea and Kim Jong-un has never said that. There's no evidence that Kim Jong-un promised to unilaterally disarm. And the risk is that if President Trump really believes that, and this tweet is referring to the full disarmament process and not just the testing moratorium, then we really do have a problem, because if President Trump continues to believe that Kim Jong-un promised to disarm and will disarm, and is not just pretending to believe it, then we really have a problem, because Kim Jong-un never agreed to that. You know, I do find it ironic, you know, Trump is tweeting this from Japan, which is where the ally that is most concerned about where the process is, because, you know, when President Trump says he's not concerned about short or medium range ballistic missiles, he's sitting in Tokyo with Prime Minister Abe, who is most concerned particularly about those missile ranges. And so just the irony of tweeting that from Japan, I think, shouldn't be lost on us. And also, you know, we haven't talked a lot about the fact that President Trump in this tweet decided to invoke Kim Jong-un to attack a domestic opponent. And that is opens up a whole Pandora's box about, you know, is it really, you know, appropriate for the president to appeal to the affirmation of a dictator when attacking Joe Biden, who was vice president of the United States? I mean, that there's a lot going on in that tweet. I think that was some of the most interesting and dynamic 280 characters a president has tweeted in a while.
Vipin Narang, associate professor of political science at MIT, speaking via Skype with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Trump in Tokyo downplays concern about North Korea. Thousands march in Hong Kong to mark June 4th protests. Experts say combine U.S.-South Korea missile systems to boost defense versus North. U.S. envoy makes rare visit to Tibet. Drones monitor whale health in Australia. Expanded coverage of all these stories can be found online at VOA Asia Facebook, as well as the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The UN Refugee Agency says water rations for tens of thousands of Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh have been cut because of a serious shortage. The UNHCR says it soon will have to truck water into refugee settlements. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Summer temperatures in southeast Bangladesh's Teknaf Peninsula can reach 40 degrees Celsius. That is not a good time for the water well to run dry. The UN Refugee Agency reports sporadic rainfall since November has reduced the region's water supply to a critically low level. UNHCR spokesman Andrei Mihecic says aid agencies will begin trucking in water in the next 2 weeks for the more than 140,000 Rohingya refugees living there. He estimates the operation will cost about $60,000 a month. Because of the growing shortage, he tells VOA, the UNHCR began rationing the refugees' daily water supply to make it last longer.
We are talking here about 20 liters a day. This is a minimum standard in an emergency. And we, because of the shortage of water, had to go even lower now to 15 liters a day per person. This is supposed to meet all of people's need for water during the day. So from hygiene, preparing food, sanitation, everything.
Mahechich notes the situation is different in the northern part of Bangladesh's Teknaf Peninsula. He says the 900,000 Rohingya refugees living in the Kutupalong settlement in Cox's Bazar have water available through boreholes. The dry spell in the southern part of the peninsula is expected to last a few more weeks. It will likely be broken by masses of rain when the monsoon season begins later in June. In preparation, Mahechich says the UNHCR is building better facilities to capture and preserve rainwater. He says hundreds of refugees are participating in a project to create a new local reservoir to capture monsoon rain in Teknaf and preserve it throughout the year. He says the project, which is run by the World Food Program with humanitarian agency ADRA and supported by UNHCR, should temporarily improve the situation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Happening now in Asia, two powerful explosions in Kathmandu, Nepal's capital, killed three people and injured at least five others Sunday. Although no group has claimed responsibility, police suspect that an outlawed communist organization, the Splinter Communist Group, was responsible for the blasts. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today as we begin a brand new week on VOA Asia. The 32nd annual Rolling Thunder demonstration has been held here in Washington. Tens of thousands of motorcycle riders gather during the Memorial Day weekend each year to urge the U.S. government to resolve many veterans' issues, most pressing the more than 83,000 U.S. soldiers still listed as missing in action from conflicts dating back to World War I. Amid online chatter that the demonstration might continue, organizers say this year's ride was the last in Washington because of a variety of reasons, including the cost of holding the event and the fact that many of the veterans who have been involved for more than three decades are becoming too old to continue. Sergeant Artie Muller has been leading the Rolling Thunder for the majority of its run. I spoke with him Sunday as riders lined up for their bikes in the massive Pentagon parking lots, preparing for one last ride around the D.C. Mall.
The ride in Washington, D.C., we've made a decision, is coming to an end. I know there's been some tweets out there from President Trump, and we appreciate that. And we're going to have some meetings with him when he comes back from Japan and what he's doing. And we're willing to talk, but I think we really want to go nationwide. We have... 90 chapters nationwide, and we're in all states all over the country. And if we're not that state, we're in all the ones around it. So, you know, we can do events anywhere. And we were discussing doing them on the East Coast, West Coast, North, down South, Midwest, all over, and have the chapters work together. There's a lot of veterans and non-veterans out there, supporters that support us, and they want to be here. Too expensive, they don't have the money. They work and they can't get off of work. And a lot of them are, we're all getting old.
Right.
You know, one way or the other, you're getting old. And they can't ride that far, you know. Coming from California, the West Coast area, even up north, it's a haul, you know. You're talking 2,000-3,000 miles.
That's a long way.
And that's a long way, and that takes a lot out of you. It's a very patriotic event. People come from all over because they believe in it. It's not just Americans. I mean, you know, it's Orientals and it's Spanish and, you know, people from all over the world. We have people coming here from Wake Island, from Guam, from the Netherlands, from Australia, from Austria. Canada comes down every year.
32 years, Artie, what are some of the accomplishments you think this ride has achieved?
Well, we've got a lot of legislation passed so our government cannot just write off prisoners of war missing in action. We passed so much legislation. We've got the POW flag to fly over all the memorials in Washington, D.C., all the veterans' memorials. We have gotten legislation passed to take better care of the veterans and our troops. The one bill back at the beginning of the Gulf War that we had passed before that war started brought home Jessica Lynch and the other six POWs. They brought them home alive. And why? Because the legislation we passed, stated that if somebody in a foreign country that we're fighting a war with gives us information on a live American POW and we capture them and bring them home, we will bring them and their family to the United States. And it brought them home. Jessica Lynch and the other six would have been dead or never found again. You know?
What remains unresolved?
Live American POW. Many were captured in World War I, II, Korea, Vietnam, everything in between. Accounted for everybody in the Gulf War and Iraq War so far. I haven't accounted for those from Korea or Vietnam. I think it might be a little too late for anybody in World War II.
This event has become so big over the years, and you've become a bit of a rock star. What's for you next, Artie?
You know what? That's funny because I've given quite a few talks at different schools and some colleges, and some kids had a patch made up for me. Artie and the Vets, they thought we were a band. and it was funny. That's cute. That's cool.
U.S. Sergeant Artie Muller, the executive director of Rolling Thunder. Coming up, a whale of a drone. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. U.S. President Donald Trump is in Japan for a four-day state visit, heavy on ceremony and sports, although a senior White House official promises there'll be some substantive things to announce. Trump has already met with several top dozen of Japanese business leaders. Visit VOA Asia Facebook for much more. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, a waterproof drone is being used by Australian scientists to collect the highly treasured nasal mucus of migrating whales. The snot is rich with fresh DNA, viruses, and bacteria, and it's collected by a drone that hovers over the blowhales of humpback whales as they embark on their epic annual journey along the Australian east coast. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Whales, like all mammals, need air and come to the surface to breathe through a blowhole. Vanessa Perotta, a marine biologist at Macquarie University, says that nasal mucus indicates the health of the whale.
It's the juicy biological mixture that you see as a whale takes a breath as they surface from the water. You often see that plume and it sounds like this, like, as a whale breathes, because after all, they're mammals like you and I, and they have two nostrils, and that's the humpback whale that I'm talking about. So as they take a breath, it's a lot of lung bacteria coming out from their lungs, which we can collect to provide a snapshot of whale health.
Australian researchers have attached a petri dish that's used in scientific tests to a drone which flies through the whale's nasal mist. Vanessa Perotta again.
As a whale comes to take a breath, you can actually see it coming through the surface on really good weather days, that is. The drone then lowers, the petri dish is then opened, and the drone is flown through the densest part of the whale's snot, collecting the sample in the petri dish. Now, once this happens, the lid is shut and the drone is flown back to the research vessel and we collect the sample to later process it in the laboratory.
The research could help to solve one of the mysteries of another magnificent creature of the deep, the southern right whale. Its numbers have recovered on Australia's west coast since hunting was outlawed. but its population on the eastern seaboard remains stubbornly low. In the past, studies into whale health had to rely on examining whales that were either killed or those whales that had been stranded on a beach. Drones allow scientists to collect samples from free-swimming whales to gather information in a safe and non-invasive way. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news from VOA Asia. In a rare visit to Tibet, U.S. Ambassador to China Terry Branstad urged Beijing to engage in substantive dialogue with exiled Tibetan Buddhist leader the Dalai Lama. A spokesperson to the U.S. Embassy said the U.S. envoy also raised long-standing worries about the lack of consistent access to the area. You may access VOA Asia Facebook every day. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the Mariana Trench at 11,000 meters is the deepest part of the Earth. But even at these depths, 11 kilometers below the ocean surface, one explorer found both new species and leftover plastic that we throw away. VOA's Kevin Enix gets to the bottom of the story.
This is what the ocean floor looks like at its deepest point. For the explorer on board the limiting factor submersible, just getting there was a challenge.
It was an amazing experience. It was an amazing dive. I think almost exactly 12 hours, about 3.5 down, 4 hours on the bottom. I think the longest anyone's ever been on the bottom of the Challenger Deep, and then about 4 hours up. I went through pretty much all of my electrical power and had to be swapping batteries around and circuits around.
The expedition is the brainchild of explorer Viktor Venkovo, who is attempting to map the world's deepest places.
The oceans are 70% of the Earth, and they're very deep. And there are so many things about the ocean that we don't understand. How it interacts with the atmosphere to exchange heat, how it does carbon capture. The more we know about the ocean, the more we can understand the actual chemical processes that result in global change of any kind.
What Venkovo saw wasn't a barren moonscape, but a new world full of unique fish species and rocks covered by living things that have never seen the sun.
We actually saw bacterial mats, which was life occurring on the surface of the rocks, and it was getting its energy not from photosynthesis, from the sunlight, which is how we get all of our energy on the land. They were getting it from methane and the minerals in the rocks themselves. It was chemosynthesis, so it's a different form of life.
But what he also found here was plastic.
But as I continued going along the bottom, cruising around, I did see what appeared to be one or two particles of man-made matter. I don't know if they were plastic or metal, but they definitely had sharp edges, and one of them had what looked like a letter on it, printed. So they were obvious contamination.
If it's confirmed, Venkovo's dive is the deepest ever made by a manned submersible. The previous record held by filmmaker James Cameron. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
In addition to your mother, science now says you should eat broccoli, as VOA's Rick Pantaleo takes a moment to explain.
This is Science in a Minute.
As a young child, you may have been ordered to eat your broccoli because it's good for you. Well, this sage advice is actually based in science. Past studies provided evidence that broccoli and other cruciferous vegetables like cabbage, cauliflower, and Brussels sprouts may play a role in inhibiting the growth of common forms of human cancer. A new study led by Dr. Pier Paolo Pandolfi at Boston's Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center suggests that a gene called WWP1 produces an enzyme that interferes with the work of a powerful cancer-suppressing gene called PTEN. Working with mice, Dr. Pandolfi and his team found evidence that I3C, a compound found in cruciferous vegetables, can shut down the production of this enzyme that keeps PTEN from doing its job in fighting cancer. The study was published in the journal Science. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We say hello and thank you to all of our listeners in Myanmar who have joined us on Facebook on VOA Burmese. Thanks for listening. Our thanks go to director Tracy Carter, engineer Aiden Utku, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.